Welcome back to the Mike McEntee Show here on AM 950. Joe Radinovich knows how tough it can be to win in Minnesota's 8th Congressional District. He was Representative Rick Nolan's campaign manager in 2016 when the Democrat won despite Donald Trump winning the district by a large margin. Now with Nolan not running for re-election, Radinovich is seeking his old boss's seat in a very crowded DFL field, and he joins us right now on the program. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Mike, how are you? I think you probably know, but I know how difficult it is to win Minneapolis, too.
Yes. You just took a job as Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey's chief of staff after running his campaign, and you just quit it so you could run for this seat. So I guess the decision by Nolan had to be a surprise to you.
Yeah, it was definitely a surprise to me. Rick had called me that morning before the release went out. He and I have obviously been close over the years. I represented the area that he lived in when I was a state legislator in Crow Wing and Aiken County. And, of course, I ran that 2016 race, which, is, as you had mentioned, was very competitive. So I was saddened by his call. It wasn't the news I was expecting to hear, but he encouraged me to consider a run, and it took me a few days to kind of think my way through it, but it's too important of a race not to join in, and I think that the issues that we have an opportunity to talk about are too important to the Democratic coalition to not take this opportunity.
Well, let's talk about the issues, because that's where we are right now. This is a campaign that is first going to be decided by DFL delegates in a convention, and may get decided in a primary after that. A lot of issues come up, and one of the big issues in the 8th Congressional District, which seems to just divide the DFL, is mining versus the environment. Where do you stand on that? And do you think, I don't know if it is mining versus the environment, but it's certainly a schism in the party.
Yeah, it is a schism in the party, and I think it's a false choice pushed at Democrats by often Republicans. And you know, my position on that issue is that as Democrats, I think we should believe in science. I think that we need to have a clear science-based process with high standards that, you know, accounts for other resources in the area. And that if there is a project that's approved for these minerals, it needs to be done so in such a way that there is a financial contingency set aside to ensure that the cleanup can be done after the life of the project and even after the life of the company. And if there's one approved, we need to have close oversight during the construction operation of the mine to make sure that it was done as they said it was done and done as it was approved by regulators. But, Mike, that's actually the most important issue I think facing Democrats, especially in rural America, is kind of at the heart of this division that we have, too. And that issue, I think, is the displacement of people, working people, through mechanization and technology. And I use the example on the Iron Range that in 1980, there were 39 million tons of iron ore mined from the ground, and it took about 14,500 miners. In 2015, you could have taken that same 39 million tons of iron ore from the ground at full production, and it would have taken 4,500 miners. And that situation is playing out on our farms and in our factories, and with the coming of driverless cars, entire industries are going to be displaced. And it's that disruption to the economy that's really created a lot of problems for working people. You know, it used to be at that time that people could come out of high school and work in the mines or on the farms and make sure that they could care for themselves and the people around them. And as we deal with that changing economy, there's an anxiety in workers that I think Democrats have to be able to offer solutions to in order to win in places like the 8th District.
And I agree with you. And I think those mining jobs aren't going to come back. The mechanization is going to go forward. And I think you're dealing with two ends of the spectrum here. You have people who probably can prepare for the jobs of the future. And then you have people who are in their 50s and 60s who are looking forward towards retirement and suddenly find themselves out of work and can't do anything. And retraining at that stage in your life is not exactly easy. I think you're talking about different solutions here when you're looking at that whole spectrum. How do you approach something like that?
Yeah, for me, I think that, number one, you know, people where I come from aren't looking for a handout as the economy changes. What they're looking for is government to understand the problems that they're dealing with. And so what I see for folks on the younger end of the spectrum, people my age, younger, are dealing with, number one, issues around childcare. Childcare has become so expensive that oftentimes people are left to decide whether both parents can afford to work or whether it's more efficient for one to stay home and take care of the children. That's not an optimal situation. That puts people in a position where they're not choosing from their best options. So I think that we need to do more. I was a co-author on the all-day kindergarten passage when I was in the state legislature. I think we need to do more to expand scholarships and opportunity for kids in the pre-K, at the pre-K level. Another thing, you know, you mentioned retraining and training. I think that community colleges and technical colleges are especially well-positioned to be able to help people do that. So if you're coming out of high school, it's a community college or a technical college in the area that's especially attuned to what the local economic demand is. And so where I come from in the Crosby area, there's Central Lakes College in Brainerd, and they've been able to pair with St. Scholastica to create a four-year nursing program to address the shortage of nurses in that area. And so it's that flexibility and that adaptability that becomes very important. For those folks who are towards the end of their career, number one, you know, as we've seen with the Republican tax bill that was passed, Paul Ryan came out today and he chalked up the projected deficit to what he calls entitlement programs. And so I think that we, number one, need to protect what we have with Social Security and Medicare, but we also, for future generations, need to expand that. And so I believe in universal single-payer health care, which is a prime concern of people who are both young and aging, and it allows people to decouple work from their ability to have health care. And so I think that allows for more flexibility and movability in the economy as well. But we also need to make sure, and this has been an issue for especially the Teamsters lately, that where there have been pensions and where there are problems with these pensions, we need to do more as a government to either help supplement, you know, shortages or make sure that there are programs that people can rely on. And in the Teamsters case, and I don't want to go too long here, but in the case of the Teamsters, for years, these folks had bargained in good faith, and the workers kept their end up in terms of meeting the obligations to the pension, but companies were allowed to defer their obligations. And in many cases, the companies went out of business or, you know, folded up before they had made good on their obligations. And so there are massive shortfalls there. We don't want to see that happen with the Teamsters or anybody else.
Yeah, and we're seeing that, I think, even in the public sector unions, that there are reduced expectations of what pensions are going to put out. And there's bills in the legislature right now. I just went to a hearing this last week where I heard some pretty incredible stories about people who were expecting to retire, and now it doesn't look like they can because of the reduced amount of money that's going to be coming out of these pensions. So that is a big, big problem that's looming on many, many different levels for us.
Yeah, it definitely is. And I've known some folks who were Teamsters who, you know, had proposed that their pensions would be cut in half or by a third. And I approach this from, if you step back at the macro level, we live in the richest nation the world has ever known. And it's, you know, it's provided a lot of opportunity and a lot of benefit for people. But what we know is happening is that while the gross domestic product is going up and while the stock market is soaring, not everybody is sharing in the gains. And we just from a simple perception of fairness, we know that if the money were more evenly divided, that working people would be able to take care of themselves and they'd have more freedom to make the decisions that they know are best for themselves and their family. And so I don't buy this excuse by a lot of people that there's a scarcity of resources in this country. It's simply that, you know, there's been an uneven distribution of it. And while gains have been seen, the slice of the pie that's belonged to workers has been diminishing.
I want to bring you back. You mentioned your term in the House, and you had one term in the House, and you had one vote, I think, that probably cost you your last election, your re-election. And I want to know if you want to talk. Can you talk about that vote and what you've thought about it since and what people have said to you?
Yeah. You know, that vote is I've thought about it a lot. I've talked about it a lot. It means a lot to me. And that vote was obviously the vote for marriage equality. And, you know, there's a lot of stories that I could tell about this, but part of my life and part of my narrative and even now part of my stump speech, it hasn't been easy, but this is something I talk about because it's very important to me. But, you know, I dealt with a lot of tragedy in my early life. In high school, you know, suicide and, you know, an attempted suicide by a very close family member of mine while I was there at the house, you know, was something I dealt with my junior year. And the following year, I lost my mother in a murder-suicide. And wow. When I was at my worst and needed the most help, I had people around me who were there for me. And some of those people, most of them were teachers, but some of those teachers themselves were gay, and they had been in the closet their entire career because of what a fear of coming out would do to them. And so when I was elected to the legislature in 2012, that election in 2012 had the marriage amendment on the ballot. 62.5% of my district voted to define marriage as between a man and a woman. And when the dust cleared on the election and we knew that we had the Democratic House and the Democratic Senate and Governor Dayton in office, we knew that this question would be coming to us. And, you know, I advocated first in the caucus and then publicly that we should pass marriage equality. And the reason I did is because, number one, I believe that people who, you know, would seek to discriminate against others shouldn't, and people who don't feel comfortable, you know, telling others who they are, shouldn't find their justification for that in our laws. And in a very real and acute way, in the lead up to that vote, in the year or two prior to that, there were some really high profile suicides by especially young gay men in Anoka High School. There was Tyler Clementi out at Rutgers University. And at the time, there was a story written that said that young gay men were 6 times more likely to commit themselves, or to kill themselves rather, than someone like me, a straight man in that same age group. And I just couldn't, knowing that that was the case and knowing that it was linked to a law that I had the ability to participate in changing, I knew that if I didn't, or if we passed on that opportunity, then I would have felt I was complicit in prolonging an injustice. And so I advocated for that. I supported it. And when I came out publicly in support of it, the Republicans in my district first tried to recall me and weren't able to do that. And then they were able to beat me narrowly in that November election. But I do want to say that, you know, while it made things more difficult for me in my election, it was the right decision. And it made me feel good about my term in the House. And so when I went out through that 14 election, I knocked more doors than any other House Democrat that year. And I also raised more money than anybody who wasn't self-funding because, number one, I wanted to win that seat again because it was so important to be able to do the things that we could do then. But also, I mean, it gave me a sense of pride in my service, and I don't regret that at all.
We're speaking with Joe Radinovich, who's running for the 8th Congressional District on the DFL side. It is a crowded field right now. There are 4 other candidates, at least, who have announced. There's I'm going to run through the names here because I got to make sure we mention everybody. Kirsten Hagan Kennedy, who is a mayor up there on the range. Michelle Lee, who is a former TV anchor. Lee Pfeiffer, who is an activist. And Jason Metza, who is a current representative. And I was watching a hearing today that Jason Metza was speaking at, and it was about the wild rice bill. This is about water quality, and he's supporting that. He's supporting making changes in it, and a lot of environmentalists are against that. Where are you on that issue?
You know, I didn't follow today's proceedings, but I think the bill was actually introduced in the House by the guy who beat me in election in 2014, Dale Lewis. But
it was.
Yeah. So we, again, you know, these issues of the false choice between the environment and jobs is something that continually gets driven at us as a wedge. Now, I support a science-based process, and I support, you know, the appropriate review here. I do think that there have been some questions about the particular science in a specific study done in northern Minnesota about the level of sulfates in the water relative to iron content. And so the question really has to do with wild rice. And all of us want wild rice to grow and thrive in our lakes and rivers, and that's why we should seek to improve water quality up north and across the state, especially where wild rice is concerned. But there are some questions, I think, specifically about whether those sulfates activate in such a way that the wild rice seedling, I think it is diminished in the presence of iron. And so, you know, I'd like to see more science reviewed on that, and I'd like to, you know, kind of participate in the conversation from there. So I don't know the specifics of the bill that was introduced today. I just was told about it briefly when I was on the way up here.
Yeah, fair enough. My point here, my bigger point was that this is a crowded field. We've got 4 other candidates. A lot of people are expecting that nobody's going to get the endorsement in the convention coming up here. I think you have to get 60%, if I'm correct, to get the endorsement in the from the DFL. With that many candidates splitting the vote, it's not likely. What are you focusing on right now? Are you focusing on those delegates and the DFL endorsement, or are you looking beyond that and saying, hey, we're going to have to run a primary race here?
Yeah, so I'm seeking the endorsement. I intend to abide by it. I've always been a party activist. That's kind of how I came up through the system here. I came out to caucus in 2008, like a lot of people did, and I started raising my hand when they asked if people wanted to participate and help out, and that was something I was interested in. And so I value the time that these activists are putting into this. I value their judgment, and I think the best way to have a unified party is for all of the folks involved to respect the endorsement outcome. Now, I don't know what the other candidates are planning to do, but I do know that I spend a lot of my day, number one, you know, like everybody else, raising the money necessary to continue this campaign, but number two, talking to delegates across the district. And I think that, you know, despite getting in after the caucus, which is when I announced my entry in the race, I think that there's a good chance that I could earn an endorsement here. And I'm in Malacca, Minnesota right now, sitting outside of a senior center because we've got a meet and greet here in a few minutes. And I'm going to go in and talk to those delegates about the issues that are important to them and see how we do. But for me, this race is really about a couple things. One, it's about why I think it's important. I talked about that, the changing economy. And number two, I think it's also important that we have somebody who can win. And I think winning in the 8th district, which is a district that Donald Trump won by 16 points, means holding the coalition together and going the extra mile to make sure that I'm listening to the concerns of people who may not agree with me on every issue, but I also want to talk to them about what a path to victory looks like in this race so that we can have somebody in Washington, D.C., who is broadly representing Democratic interests and is fighting on behalf of working people.
I got to ask you one more question before you head in, and I know you got to run to that, but Representative Rick Nolan, every time I talk to him, his biggest complaint about his second go-through in Congress was having to raise money, having to spend so much time raising money that he didn't get enough time to focus on actually doing the work he wanted to. Do you have the stomach for doing that kind of fundraising, and are you planning to do anything about getting money out of politics?
Yeah, so let me be first very clear. I support broadly Rick Nolan's major initiatives, which were always about protecting and expanding Social Security and Medicare and fighting for working people. But the third always was ending the corrupting influence of money in our political system. And he had a unique position to talk about that because he had served previously and then came back later. And I think that he probably thinks, as I do, that our political system or the way we do politics is really the root problem here. And so, you know, it would be my intent to pick up where Rick left off and to support the move to amend and end to Citizens United. I think that the best way to probably get to a place where we're happy or more happy anyway with the type of elections we have is to have a constitutional amendment addressing these very real concerns. Without a change in the court, there's probably no real way to make the type of change we need otherwise. However, unfortunately, this is definitely not going to happen before 2018. And so I'm doing what every candidate who, you know, should hope to win is, which is I'm spending time on the phone trying to raise money. And it's not very fun. And I would say that the real issue with it for your listeners, in my opinion, is not so much that there's a quid pro quo relationship, but it's about access. And so if I spend all day on the phone talking to people who can help me with the campaign, certainly I appreciate their contributions. But a person who can write a $2,700 check to a candidate or a $5,400 check to a candidate doesn't typically have a lot of the same concerns as the people back home where I'm from, you know, where my folks are, my dad's an electrician, brother's electricians. You know, for them, a $50 contribution is a meaningful contribution in a political race, and it's a demonstration of their clear and earnest intent to support somebody who they know believes in their values. And that's really what this is about for me. It's about the grassroots and about the people who most need an advocate in Washington. So I don't like that part of the job, but until it changes, I'm going to spend my time doing as much as I need to in order to win and take those values that I have and that people back home have to Washington, D.C.
Joe Radinovich is a candidate for the DFL endorsement in the 8th Congressional District. He's been very kind to spend some of his time with us today. Joe, go off to your next event, but thank you so much for talking with us.
I appreciate it, Mike. Take care.
Take care.